Boston.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Daniel Goldhagen does not shy away from controversy. His bombshell bestseller, Hitler's Willing Executioners, put ordinary Germans in the moral hot seat for their role in the mass executions of Jews during World War II. Now he's pulling up a chair at the table for the Catholic Church. In this hour, Daniel Goldhagen's call for a deep moral reckoning. First, we turn to Washington with news that the United States is moving ahead with preparations for possible war with Iraq. Today's Washington Post reports that U.S. embassies in 50 countries have been ordered to sound out foreign leaders about their willingness to join the U.S. in war if Iraq fails to comply with weapons inspections. Vernon Loeb is the defense correspondent for the Washington Post. I asked him to describe the significance of the administration's new push for allies.
They've realized that this is not a war that they want to fight on their own. I guess ever eager to show that they're not unilateralists, they are out there building perhaps a second coalition to go at Iraq with if the first coalition that they've pulled together via the UN inspections process falls apart or isn't adequate.
So you're talking then about an inspections coalition and perhaps to follow that a war coalition.
Exactly. They went the inspections route through the UN on the belief that it would be much better to have international support for military action against Iraq than going it alone. This is very much Colin Powell's argument in the cabinet. I think what we're seeing now is a kind of backup plan, and that is they believe only credible military force will make Saddam Hussein take the inspections process seriously. And they want to be able to show Saddam Hussein that they have that credible force in the form of an international coalition of countries of the willing, as they like to call it.
And yet you've written, Vernon Loeb, that foreign military units would have little to offer the U.S. in an assault on Iraq, that their technology simply isn't up to U.S. technology. They couldn't really move alongside U.S. units. So what is it that the United States needs?
Well, I think they need symbolic support, they need political cover, and they need peacekeepers, quite frankly, once the military action is over. I guess the feeling sort of is, well, you can't help us that much on the battlefield, but we're very interested in your help in the peacekeeping phase of the war once the battle is over.
Are there any allies who would be, will be, a real material comrades in arms in this war? The British, the French, are there any militaries now that can really run with the U.S. military?
I think the British can and will be a material ally. I think some of the preliminary war plans call for British airborne forces and U.S. Marines occupying sort of a southern sector in Iraq. So I think the British are very much players. There's been some talk about an Australian brigade being part of the British force. Beyond that, I don't think we're likely to see any other foreign countries' combat forces on the battlefield, perhaps with the exception maybe of some small numbers of special forces here and there.
50 countries are reportedly being sounded out for their willingness to join in the action, at least to be on the list. How far afield is the Bush administration looking?
They're looking all over the world. Certainly they're looking to NATO allies. I think we saw the president signal today that he's very much interested in having NATO support in a military action against Iraq, and basically they're willing to take support from any place they can get it.
President Bush said today, great evil is stirring in the world. Is this the kind of line that embassies are taking to the countries that they're seeking help from? Is this rhetoric that moves countries to become fully public allies in this effort?
I wouldn't think so. I think they'd probably take a much more pragmatic line. They'll be trying to sell countries on participation in a coalition on the basis of Saddam's demonstrated unwillingness to engage in a meaningful inspections regime. I think they're basically going to countries saying, we'd like to see the inspection succeed as much as you would. However, we have our doubts, and we want to make sure that if Saddam Hussein thumbs his nose again at the UN process, we have a credible alternative to disarm Iraq. Will you join us?
When the U.S. comes to say that, is it all by attraction, or is there some arm twisting here, too? Is this an offer that countries cannot refuse?
There is some moral force to that argument. Do you want the UN to be a meaningful body or not? And can the international community allow Saddam Hussein to simply thumb his nose at this process? if you believe that's not a good idea, if you believe that's not good for the world community, then you need to join with us in taking affirmative steps to disarm this regime.
Vernon Loeb, what's your guesstimate? How will this coalition end up looking compared, let's say, to the coalition that fought the first Persian Gulf War?
My guess is it probably won't be as broad. Germany already has pretty much opted out of the process. I'm not sure Saudi Arabia will be nearly as willing a partner as it was in the first Gulf War. There's some real doubts as to whether the Saudis will allow us to launch combat missions from Saudi soil as the Saudis did in the Gulf War. So I think it'll be probably a more limited coalition.
Will it be sufficient to materially support a war effort if it comes to that?
Sure, because the war effort itself doesn't really require anyone else's support.
Well, except for overflight, for landing rights, for backup hospitals, all that sort of thing?
I think they already have the logistics in the region to do the war without the Saudis. I think they'd rather have much fuller participation by the Saudis than they now have, but they have bases in Kuwait, they have bases in Turkey, they have bases in Oman, in Qatar. They can count on the Jordanians for some assistance. They have lots of firepower and air power sitting off in the Persian Gulf in the form of aircraft carriers. So they can logistically pull this war off pretty much with what they've got lined up already. What they're looking for now is a sort of symbolic and political underpinning for a military action against Iraq should the inspections process fall apart.
Vernon Loeb, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Vernon Loeb is defense correspondent with The Washington Post. He spoke with me earlier from Washington. Political scientist and writer Daniel Goldhagen speaks his mind. He made that plain with his 1996 bestseller, Hitler's Willing Executioners. His new book, A Moral Reckoning, The Role of the Catholic Church in the Holocaust and Its Unfulfilled Duty of Repair, is equally bold. It is not enough, says the former Harvard professor, for the church to acknowledge its role in the Holocaust. The Catholic Church owes Jews more than that. It owes them repair for wrongs done and ultimately a reconsideration of the Bible itself. Do you accept this depth of Catholic responsibility in the Holocaust? Has too little been asked in moral reckoning? Does this critique ask too much? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Daniel Goldhagen. His new book is A Moral Reckoning, The Role of a Catholic Church in the Holocaust and Its Unfulfilled Duty of Repair. Good evening and welcome, Daniel Goldhagen.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being with us. And I made a mistake at the very top of the hour saying 2 years ago the first book came out. It was 6 years ago. Seems like only yesterday. You've been making waves long after the book came out, and it looks like you're about to do it again. We want to dive in tonight both to the problem that you describe in terms of culpability, I'm not sure, responsibility, role, we'll hear the word that you use, but also into what you describe as a moral reckoning. And it's a very deep, broad definition of what that would constitute. But give us a summary of A, what's the problem, and B, what needs to be done to fix it.
The problem is a historical one, and it's also a contemporary problem. The Catholic Church had persecuted Jews for centuries, and the persecution which the Church participated in during the Holocaust became quite acute. And the Church committed not just crimes of omission or offenses of omission, as people would have it, but it actually committed many crimes, that is, bishops and priests individually, and also the Vatican and Pope Pius XII, and many other offenses. So the book first describes the problem. It then says that contrary to how we've typically written about the Holocaust and other mass murders, we actually have to think about how we judge people, mm-hmm. because people shouldn't get off scot-free, quite obviously, and judgment is more complicated than simply saying people are guilty or innocent, guilty of crimes. There are other blameworthy things people do aside from committing crimes. And then once the judgment is rendered and there is a more nuanced way that is proposed in the book of judging people's culpability for crimes and other offenses, we must talk about repair, which is a subject which will surprise people to hear has never been written about in a systematic, sustained way about the Holocaust, other genocides, or other great crimes of violence in the past or the present. What does repair mean? How do the perpetrators, when they recognize the harm, repair it as best they can? What duties do they have? And so the book explores this both in principle, it lays out a set of principles for repair and then applies them to the church and shows what the church must do according to these principles of repair, which are universal principles, and even according to its own doctrine, which I discuss at great length.
And you are not shy about laying out what that repair might include, even including rewriting in the Bible. You leave that, you say, up to the church ultimately to decide, but you're saying, here's where anti-Semitism is rooted. You need to look at it. Maybe you need to fix it.
Well, one of the principles of repair, well, let me just say the three principles of repair very quickly. It's tell the truth about the past, which the church decidedly has not done, and we can discuss all of these in greater detail as you wish. The second is to combat the continuing effects of the harm. The harm didn't end in 45 when the war ended. There are continuing effects, principally a great deal of anti-Semitism among Catholics. Not all Catholics are anti-Semitic. And then third, what you need to do in order to repair the harm is to look within yourself or your institution to the unwholesome sources of the harm and transform them so you will never be a source of the harm again. And this brings us to the question of the Christian Bible, commonly called the New Testament, which has been the source of the anti-Semitism through the ages.
We're going to come to that. But before we get there, I guess we need some sense of your bill of particulars about Roman Catholic culpability. And you're careful to say in the book, look, it's not just Catholics who bear responsibility here. It extends to Protestants. It extends to political groups of all sorts and stripes, and of course to the Nazi Party and Nazi leadership of Germany above all. But when you look at Catholic culpability, how do you see it? How do you define it?
It's not Catholic culpability per se. I look at culpability and then apply it to the church, to bishops and priests individually, national churches, and to the Vatican and the Pope. And let me just give you some of the things that they did, generally speaking. They promoted anti-Semitism. Even throughout the 1930s, 1940s, even while the Jews were being slaughtered, they continued to tell their faithful that Jews are essentially a guilt-laden people responsible for many harms.
And when you say they here, you're talking about particular people in particular parishes, churches, wings of the Vatican.
All over. I mean, it was an article of faith of the Catholic Church. The Jews were guilty for all time, cursed for all time because of the death of Jesus. This was a standard teaching of the church. And then there were many more particulars. Let me just read you a very brief passage from the Bishop of Sarajevo, which in a pastoral letter he issued to everyone in his diocese in May 1941 as the Jews are about to be killed. The descendants of those who hated Jesus, persecuted him to death, crucified him, and persecuted his disciples are guilty of greater sins than their forebears. So the Jews of the day were guilty of greater sins. Jewish greed increases. The Jews have led Europe and the world towards disaster, moral and economic disaster. Their appetite grows to only the domination of the whole world will satisfy it. Satan aided them in the invention of socialism and communism. There is a limit to love. The movement of liberation of the world, that's the Nazi movement, from the Jews, is a movement for the renewal of human dignity. Omniscient and omnipotent God stands behind this movement. I mean, it's hard to imagine a more virulent anti-Semitic incitement than this. This was a common thing from the church. So they spread anti-Semitism throughout Europe, even while the Jews were being slaughtered. They supported the race laws. The Nuremberg laws, race laws in Italy, the Vatican itself told the Italian government in 1943 that the government that had replaced Mussolini's government, that the race laws should be confirmed. The Jews are being slaughtered everywhere. The Vatican knows about it. In Slovakia, they helped to deport Jews. The president of the country was a priest. Every priest in parliament voted for deportation. The entire episcopate issued a pastoral letter justifying the deportation, calling the Jews Christ killers. Not that term, but that's the motif they invoked. And in Croatia, some priests actually were commanders of concentration camps and killed Jews themselves. This is just a small bill of particulars.
So the paper trail is a long one. I want to get a sense of where you sit in the kind of spectrum of interpretation. Do all historians draw the line from these incidents to the Vatican and say, this constitutes responsibility for the Holocaust killings?
Let's make it clear. The church did not initiate the Holocaust. It would have never done so on its own. There are many in the church who were opposed to the mass murder itself, though they supported the persecution up to the mass murder. There are some in the church who supported the mass murder. I am trying to shift the view, actually, from the Vatican, from the Pope Pius XII, where everyone has been focused, to look at the church more broadly. In this sense, I differ from many historians who are very focused on the Pope. The basic contours of this past that I've described is agreed to by historians. I mean, you know, one can disagree about nuances here or some of the details, but the basic facts are quite clear. How one assesses them and judges culpability is something that we can differ upon as well.
We're going to come back and look at that and look at the kind of reckoning that Daniel Goldhagen asks of the Catholic Church today. All these years later, the time does not matter, he says. We're talking with Daniel Goldhagen about the Catholic Church, the Holocaust, and a moral reckoning. Do you accept or doubt Catholic responsibility for the Holocaust? And is the Church too easy a target or a vital, necessary target for reckoning? Today, we're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with author Daniel Goldhagen about the Catholic Church, the Holocaust, and a moral reckoning. Do you accept or doubt Catholic responsibility for the Holocaust? And what would a full and proper moral reckoning mean to you? What would it look like? Has a reckoning already been made? Or have the words, the gestures, been too small? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Daniel Goldhagen, there has been an awful lot said and written and preached and discussed about the Holocaust and responsibility and the Church and the Catholic Church in the decades since then. But you talk about a moral black hole between then and now. What's missing here? What's in the vacuum?
In, as a set of principles, there is no systematic attempt to think about what repair is. And applying to the Church has made a great deal of progress since 45 because it was in such a terrible state, but they have only done a very small thing. The acts have been, the acts have been mainly symbolic. Of the serious acts of repair they need to do, they've undertaken the symbolic ones and not really the very hard ones. And let me just tell you, the Catholic catechism itself, its doctrine says, many sins wrong our neighbor, one must do what is possible to repair the harm. Simple justice requires as much. So that's their own doctrine. One must do what one can to repair the harm. It's not a choice. And so the question is, what principles do we use of repair? And the Church has not told the truth. It keeps the Vatican archives locked. It attacks people who tell the truth. It systematically puts out false accounts of the history. We remember the Church's own apology, alleged apology, for the Vatican was really an exercise in self-exoneration more than a full telling of the truth.
I have to say, as I read through the book, a lot of the incidents sounded familiar to me. I mean, the tenor of the reports of this happened in Sarajevo, this happened here, this happened there, this I've heard. But when it comes to the reckoning, to the repair, you really explode the tent. You make it much more grand in size, and you seem much more vigorous in the scope of what you're requiring. Walk us through the ideal. Respond to that if you will, but then walk us through the ideal kind of spectrum of what a proper reparation would be.
Okay. I'm trying to expand the notion of repair beyond what is typically is, which is money and property, restitution. Monetary repair is absolutely critical. It's not very important for the Church. The Church's duties are more moral. And I say there are two other kinds of repair. Political repair, when you destroy the political capacities of a community, when you help to destroy communities, it is your obligation to help restore them. And the Church, until 1993, did not even recognize the State of Israel because of its own supersessionist creed that it was the rightful heir of the land of Israel and the Jews weren't. And so this was a great transgression now corrected by the Church. Most important is moral repair. And the basic principles I've already mentioned, and they're very simple. Tell the truth. I mean, who can say one shouldn't tell the truth and the Church hasn't done it? Combat the continuing effects of the harm. Research shows that tens of millions of Catholics in Europe today still say that all Jews are cursed or guilty for the death of the Son of God. That's a terrible prejudice, which leads people to be prone to accepting other prejudices against Jews. What the Church needs to do is institute education at all levels, elementary, secondary, and for adults, to teach them the falseness and perniciousness of this and many other prejudicial doctrines.
So you're saying the Holocaust is the unacceptable marker. This isn't funny anymore. It never was. It's time to go in and actually change the teachings to actively push back against this kind of belief.
Right. Let me just say, the Church itself no longer officially teaches anti-Semitism. The Church
But it still resides in that.
And also, it's part of its text. It doesn't actively tell people to become anti-Semitic, but the Christian Bible, the liturgy, has much anti-Semitism in it, so it inadvertently teaches people anti-Semitism. But so first, it must have educational programs to teach people the falseness of this. I mean, and let me just say, in the discussion of its doctrine of repair, one of the examples it gives is restore the reputation of someone slandered. Well, who has been more slandered than Jews by the Church? So it needs to restore the reputation. Its own doctrine says that. And the third principle, tell the truth, repair the harm. The third is transform oneself. Mm. And repentance, actually, I keep pointing to Catholic doctrine to show that this is in line with the Church's own teachings, includes a radical reorientation of one's life. And here the Church must confront the problem that exists in its sacred text, the New Testament. This book, which teaches so many people to live good lives and has admirable principles, also has consecrated at its core an enmity towards Jews and an anti-Semitism, which has led to catastrophic results over the ages.
Has consecrated anti-Semitism at its core, yes.
I mean, when you teach people that all Jews, I keep coming back to the notorious curse that Jews allegedly pronounced upon themselves, contained in the Gospel of according to Matthew, where they say that his blood be upon us and upon all our children, which has been the source of the Christ-killing charge through the ages. Other thing, in John, it says that those who do not accept Jesus are essentially children of the devil.
What's the solution?
The solution is for the church to acknowledge that this text does spread anti-Semitism. The church denies that it does today, and for it to take measures. It's not for me to tell the church what to do with sacred texts, but it is for me to identify the problem. It must take measures to prevent Catholics from extracting anti-Semitic notions from this text, from reading it in an anti-Semitic way, and themselves having an animus towards Jews.
So the ideal in your mind is to expunge these elements of the text, to take out
the ideal. It is for the church to decide. If the church, for example, were to put in commentary in the text in which it explained how these passages should not be read in an anti-Semitic way, and I should say there are hundreds of such anti-Semitic passages. If it were to do that, put in text commentary to explain to Catholics that no one should take away anti-Semitic notions from these texts, that they have to be read historically in their context, and so on and so forth. It's not contained in the American Catholic Bible. It's virtually mute on these passages. That would already be great progress. If the church decided to extract, to remove these damaging passages, that's for the church to decide. It's not for me to say. And let me just end by saying, just to make it clear to to the listeners, imagine if a text said, blacks or Christians are children of the devil, they've never heard God, they can never hear God, they are vipers. Imagine if there are hundreds of such statements, and imagine if it said that all blacks or Christians are cursed for all time for the death of the Son of God, and that a religious institution took a book like this and said it's the Word of God and gave it to a billion people as a guide to their lives. What would people say? I mean, really, what would they say? And why, whatever they would say, why should it be any different because it says it about Jews?
And so why do we feel comfortable? I guess it's centuries of familiarity with the text.
Well, that's exactly
it. It's one answer, but maybe there's something more. Daniel Goldhagen, you are nonpareil at putting out provocative thesis, and you've got one here along with details. I want to welcome to our conversation Robert Erickson. He's joining us from Gig Harbor, Washington. He's history professor at Pacific Lutheran University and author of Theologians Under Hitler. Good evening, and welcome, Robert Erickson.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. Robert Erickson, you're a scholar in these fields yourself. You've been listening in, and of course, you're familiar with Daniel Goldhagen's new book. How do you interpret what you see here? Is this, first of all, a portrayal of the Catholic Church's role before and during World War II and the Holocaust that lines up with the generally accepted notion of its responsibilities? And what do you make of the lines that Daniel Goldhagen draws between that portrayal and what he describes as a moral reckoning?
First of all, in terms of the portrayal of the Catholic Church, I've actually spent most of my career talking about ways in which Christians in Germany supported the Nazi state and participated in the same sort of anti-Semitism that he's describing, a willingness to accept the Nazi mistreatment of the Jews.
So this is very familiar ground to you.
It's very familiar ground, and it's true of both Protestants and Catholics within Germany. The way in which he's isolating the Catholic Church in this particular book might be questioned. I think it's broader than that. But also,
I would agree with that, of course.
Yeah, I don't think you have a problem with saying that Protestants were also anti-Semitic.
Oh, you say that in the book, and you say, in fact, Daniel Goldhagen, that you isolate Catholics because they have a strong historical tradition of speaking publicly to moral issues.
Well, also, and I want to give Professor Erickson a chance to continue. We interrupted him, but also because it's a case study of the Catholic Church. I could have done it, I say, quite explicitly about Protestant churches. It can be applied to others as well, and I urge people to do so.
Point taken. Professor Erickson, please go on.
Right. And I also agree with the general principle that we need more and more research into the responsibility of Christians in that period and in relationship to Jewish victims and the policies of the Nazi state. There's just no question about that, and I welcome the book, and I welcome Daniel Goldhagen's work for that reason. However, there are two ways in which I would question the impact of the book and some of the arguments that are developed.
And those are?
And first of all, I am on the Committee of Church Affairs in relation to the Holocaust at the U.S. Holocaust Museum.
Mm-hmm.
And there's definitely within that community, within that group of individuals, both Catholic and Protestant, first of all, a very strong sense that Christian-Jewish dialogue is making headway, that it's productive, that it is leading toward understanding and increasing willingness on the Christian side to accept responsibility. And in fact, since 1945, there's an entire trend in theology called post-Holocaust theology in the Christian church, which has tried to come to grips with these questions and, in fact, is doing a great deal of modification.
So on that point, are you suggesting that Daniel Goldhagen's book marks a setback to this progress of dialogue between the faiths?
Well, the reason I mentioned the committee is we met last month, and there was a tremendous fear that this would simply create anger and hostility and wouldn't, in fact, improve or increase the dialogue between Jews and Christians. And
that it's pushing too hard.
So that there's a polemical tone, which was definitely feared and wasn't welcomed. Now, whether that's an accurate response or not, is subject to discussion. But throughout that committee and with many other colleagues in the field, there's that sense.
We'll take that point. And your further observation?
The second point has to do with the fact that in the first book of Daniel Goldhagen on Hitler's Willing Executioners, there was quite a widespread, I would say almost universal, criticism that developed among German historians and Holocaust historians of the polemical nature of that book. And one of the terms that was used to describe the methodology of that book is that it was prosecutorial, that it wasn't the sort of work that historians do, sifting evidence, trying to find the most balanced and accurate judgment of events, but rather fixing upon a theory, and in that case, eliminationist anti-Semitism among Germans was the running theory. And that in fixing upon that theory, the method of approaching the evidence was not an appropriate historical method.
I want Daniel Goldhagen to respond, but let me ask you first, what is wrong with a prosecutorial approach? I mean, there's clearly a giant crime here.
Yes.
Could it even be that there's a demand for a prosecutorial approach, or is this an academic issue where that's just considered gauche?
It isn't that it's gauche. And in fact, I'm very sympathetic to what you say and what Daniel Goldhagen says, that this is a massive crime, of course. I mean, I study the Holocaust, and others do, because it's one of the greatest, if not the greatest, crime of the modern world.
Nobody's doubting it, but it's the response we're looking at.
And so the question becomes, how do historians best seek to understand that event?
Robert Erickson, will you stand by while I put this to Daniel Goldhagen?
Of course.
And here are the two points. A, there's a Christian-Jewish dialogue that's made great headway. You're throwing a grenade into it. You're pushing too hard. And B, you're prosecutorial with an issue of such import that's too maybe too crude an approach.
On the first point, this is what would be understood in the academy as an exercise in applied ethics. My job as a scholar is to try to understand the principles that are at issue here and to see where they lead. And I am quite sympathetic to people who are themselves engaged in the Christian-Jewish dialogue and in Christian-Jewish relations, who are trying to negotiate very difficult intercommunal and interreligious relations. But I'm a scholar, and my job was to try to lay out what the principles of a moral reckoning are.
If your book inspires a backlash rather than a reckoning, does that matter?
I don't think that it will. I mean, in Europe, for example, we had many discussions with Catholic bishops. We had a discussion with the Catholic Academy in Hamburg, which they hosted, of these issues. I would say the opposite, that the moral issues are so dimly understood in our society. Forget about the Holocaust per se, but when we can speak of other great crimes, such as the debts owed the United States to African Americans, moral discussion, serious moral discussion is all but absent from our public life. And what we need to do is push it forward and put it on the table and give people the tools with which to have it. So We'll see. How this book affects the discussions of this particular issue. But,
you said at the Frankfurt Book Fair that the Catholic Church is already in the midst of a desperate attempt on the part of the Church to try and torpedo this book and avoid a real discussion.
Well, no, that was the Munich Archdiocese, which it's a complicated story. Which
arguing over detail in a capsule
sought an injunction to try to undermine the book. But that's a different discussion.
The second point, your prosecutorial, where it doesn't belong.
I just disagree, and partly this may be a disciplinary dispute because Professor Erickson speaks as a historian, self-described, and my book, the first book, was written very much in the vein of political science, where I tested a variety of theories. I did not harp upon one or fix upon one. I tested a variety of theories against the standard ones in the field against a bunch of new evidence which I put forward, and found that a certain account of things explained the evidence much better than others had. And historians often make the kind of criticism that he made, but they don't actually point to what's wrong with the evidence I put forward or with how I explained it. And what I always say to them is, give a better account of the evidence, and they never do it.
Robert Erickson, mm-hmm. is Daniel Goldhagen playing to the crowd here? Is that the charge, in effect, and being fast and loose?
Well, he's certainly playing to his own passions and interests and point of view. And maybe I'm not saying he's playing to the crowd, but I do agree with what he's just said, that there is a difference in the historian's approach and in a political scientist's approach. That may be a partial explanation, at least. But let me give you an example of the concern with how you use evidence and whether it's approached in a prosecutorial way. Mm. As we look at his present work on the Catholic Church in general, and not just Pius XII, as he's indicated, but mm-hmm. the entire Catholic Church, really, one of the problems that arises, in fact, there's a variety of ways to see it, Catholics in different countries in Europe behaved very differently. For example, French bishops, as he acknowledges in his work, mm-hmm. protested mistreatment of Jews. Mm. Catholics in Germany, with very rare exceptions, at least in the hierarchy, did not protest. Individual priests did. Catholics in other countries, for example, Slovakia and Croatia, the Bishop of Sarajevo that he quoted, were often very brutal in their treatment of Jews and their rhetoric about Jews. And what this suggests, I think, is that it's more complicated than saying that there is a Catholic responsibility or a Catholic foundation for the Holocaust. In fact, there are multiple factors, including national history, local circumstances, individual circumstances, and so forth, which help to explain how the Holocaust could occur. It's very helpful in my mind, and I'm committed to the idea that we must honestly, confront Christian responsibility for targeting Jews for hatred for 2,000 years. There's no question of that.
Robert Erickson, with that, we're out of time, and I know we have to let you go here at the break, but thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome, and thanks for the opportunity.
Robert Erickson is history professor at Pacific Lutheran University and author of Theologians Under Fire. We're talking with Daniel Goldhagen about the Catholic Church, the Holocaust, and a moral reckoning. Can you accept the rigor, the intensity of Daniel Goldhagen's demand for radical reckoning? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with author Daniel Goldhagen about the Catholic Church, the Holocaust, and a moral reckoning. His new book is entitled A Moral Reckoning, The Role of the Catholic Church in the Holocaust and Its Unfulfilled Duty of Repair. He makes big charges and he asks for big reparations, restitution, reckoning, to use his term. What do you think? What should the Catholic Church do today to complete its reckoning? Should the Church rewrite the Bible? And are any of us up to the standard of moral reckoning that Daniel Goldhagen requires? Is he right to ask it? Can the Church live morally without it? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Daniel Goldhagen, a lot of callers want to join us. But just before we go there, Robert Erickson raised a number of points you may want to respond. Essentially, I hear him saying, as a professional scholar, you're out of line here to some extent.
Well, just to give you an example of how he and
stylistically,
and others have reacted, every point he made at the end about a more nuanced view, he took straight from my book. I say everything that he just said in my book, and he presented it as a criticism.
So why does it come back up in this way?
It comes up because, look, with my first book and this book, I've broken taboos. Well, the first book, I spoke truthfully about ordinary Germans. I broke them. I exploded the myth.
The Germans who were supposedly just little minions
and being,
unaware.
Or being terrorized and said, look, you know, and showed that they actually believed that the persecution of the Jews was right and just, and they participated in it. And with this book, I speak truthfully and more forcefully about the church's role and particularly about its duties, which people haven't spoken about, its duties of repair. And so for people who have been engaged in the field for a long time and who have, I'm not saying they have done bad scholarship, but who've only gone so far because they don't want to take on the church, for example, you know, this is too much and they're worried about a whole bunch of things.
And you say specifically in the book, hey, I'm not going to look for decorum as my first scholar. I'm going to drag this out in the public square.
It's a set of principles. I mean, it's a moral inquiry. And it's not a prosecutorial approach, because part of any moral reckoning is to praise people who acted well. And I praise the priests who saved Jews during the war, and I praise the church for the progress that's made after the war. It just hasn't been enough.
Though I don't know if it's not prosecutorial. I mean, it's got a tone of really going after folks, maybe fully justified, but this is not patty cake.
No, no, of course not, because the crimes were immense, and the repair that needs to be done is immense, and so you have to speak plainly about it. So anyway, we can take calls. I mean, I can...
Great. So many want to join us. Let's turn to them. Peter's calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
Yes, I agree with your guest, but I have a problem with... I don't think we learn anything from history, because the state of Israel is treating the Palestinians basically like dogs. They're not allowed to have drill wells. They have curfews, so they can't work. I mean, are we learning anything from history?
Okay, we'll put it to Danny Goldhagen. Danny Goldhagen, in your book, when you ask for moral reckoning, you apply it to many scenarios around the world. You say, let's look at the Serbs and the eliminationist assaults against Bosnian Muslims, Kosovars. You look at apartheid in South Africa, even at the United States and the Civil War and the history of slavery. The caller's saying...
And the of segregation and the duties of repair that have not been fulfilled by the United States. I also say in the book that the principles apply to everyone everywhere. It applies to Israel and Israelis for the crimes and other offenses they've committed against Palestinians, and to Palestinians and other Arabs in their countries for the crimes and offenses they've done to Israel. And if people apply the principles fairly, then that's fine with me. You have to assess what the culpability is and then apply the principles of repair. It's fine with me. I mean, we can't get a discussion of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict here in any detail, but I would accept the application of the principles to it.
But only that the caller's saying, how can we speak to this history when this is going on now? Is it a problem or not?
Well, part of the – no, of course. Look, people often say, why are you looking at the Catholic Church, or why are you looking at the Holocaust when there's X, Y, and Z going on that have gone on that you don't, you know, that one hasn't dealt with? And my response is, we don't have too many moral reckonings. We don't have too much serious discussion of moral life and too much moral repair in our world. We have virtually none. So why don't we get it on the table, and why don't we start make it part squarely at the center of our public life and our political life, and apply it wherever we can. And so everyone should applaud it when it's being done.
Peter, what do you make of this response?
I don't make much of it, because we're living in the real life now. Okay. The Catholic Church, I was born a Catholic, okay? I'm not a practicing Catholic. I think it's a religion that basically should throw in a trash can. But we're living now in the real life, and Israel has a problem with Palestinians, okay? They have a problem they're doing it with these people.
Peter, we've got the perspective, and we thank you for your call. We've got another Peter on the line. Welcome. You're on the air, Peter.
Hello.
Hello. Good evening.
Good evening. I just wanted your guest to discuss the role that the American Catholic Church played both during the Second World War and after the Second World War regarding Jews. And specifically, I grew up north of Boston in Peabody, where during the McCarthy era, the church told the women that babysat for me that they couldn't enter a Jewish home. People who were in the labor movement suffered persecution. People who were capitalists in Jews suffered persecution. But it all came from the local Catholic Church.
And you're saying really... let's look closer to home. Peter, it's fascinating. Let me put it to Daniel Goldhagen. Thank you for your call. What about it? Does the responsibility jump the Atlantic?
Everybody is responsible for whatever he or she does historically or in the contemporary world. And for spreading anti-Semitism here, of course, individual priests or bishops were responsible. The American Catholic Church during the war did protest the extermination of the Jews, and in fact was extremely critical of the Vatican for its alliance or seeming alliance with the Nazis. And one should say that in the last few decades, the American Catholic Church has been at the forefront within the Catholic Church of trying to make amends with the victims. In fact, more repair has gone on here than elsewhere. And they put out a very good booklet, a teaching booklet on the Shoah, on the Holocaust, which, you know, it's not perfect, but in many ways it's admirable. And so there have been many strides here. What often happens is that members of the American Catholic Church who are involved in this mistake or pretend that what goes on here has gone on everywhere in the world. There are a billion Catholics around the world, the Catholics in every country, and this is not representative.
Not necessarily so.
I just want to say one other thing, too, something Robert Erickson said, which is important, which is that he did not criticize any of the principles that I put forward. And he's worried about the, you know, pushing too hard and the effects on Christian-Jewish relations. But my response is, why should we not speak the truth? If what I'm saying is correct, then why should we hold back? I mean, isn't it our job to put the truth out there and let a moral institution or an institution like the Catholic Church that wants to be a moral institution confront the truth instead of kind of pussyfooting around and just going only so far forward because the Church, you know, can only take so much at a time?
You're asking a lot. On the other hand, it is, as you say, an institution devoted to truth. Exactly where that line falls is what we're talking about. Sylvia's on the line from Belmont, Massachusetts. Hi, Sylvia. You're on the air.
Hi. I was wondering if the book addresses the Vatican II document on the Jews, and if so, what does it say? And if not, why not? And
are you suggesting, Sylvia, that was enough, that should have closed the book?
No, I'm just curious. I mean, I haven't read the book, so I don't know if it addresses it, and if it does, I'd like to know what the author makes of this statement.
Great. Let's look at that. Thanks for your call, Sylvia.
The Vatican II statement on the Jews, which formally lifted the curse of the ages from the Jews, was absolutely critical for the Church in moving the Church forward. And Pope John XXIII, who initiated Vatican II, was truly a heroic man and a visionary. And I discussed that. And as I said, in the post-war, there have been many other forward steps since then. The Church really has taken the active teaching of anti-Semitism out of its doctrine. It still has some things in doctrine which are deeply lamentable and indeed should not be there, such as holding the Jews responsible for preventing the salvation of non-Jews, a terrible charge to lay on anyone. Mm-hmm. But there's been a lot of progress. It's just that the progress is still mainly at the rhetorical level. They don't teach anti-Semitism anymore, but they still allow it to be spread among Catholics, and they don't actively teach Catholics the wrongness of anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm.
Sylvia, thanks for your call. We just have a minute left, Daniel Goldhagen. Mm-hmm. You've got an enormous ambition buried and not buried too deep in this book, and it ultimately comes to the scriptural text itself saying, come on, Church, think about actually changing this. Can you imagine that ever happening? Are we going to be sitting around 1,000 years from now talking about this still?
Look, if you see the trajectory of the Church, which has been progressive, the trend line is up, so to speak, they have been getting better and better on these issues. I expect...
But edits to the Bible don't happen too often.
But as I've said before, it's for the Church to decide what to do with its Bible. If it put in extensive commentary of the kind that the conservative Jewish movement has put in its own Torah, the five books of Moses, where they correct the record and teach people not to interpret passages in ways that are demeaning or damaging to other people, this would already be great progress. I mean, it's a terrible problem. I mean, it's enshrined in these statements are enshrined in the text. You know, I could throw the question back to you. You asked the question. If a text said this about blacks, what would you say?
I'm not saying it shouldn't happen, but I just ask it as a matter of interest. You're a scholar. Here's a scriptural text that's been around for a while.
I don't think that.
And I'm just wondering practically, will it happen?
I think there's room for enormous progress, teaching on the part of the Church, correcting the record, teaching Catholics how not to take anti-Semitism from this text. If it's done even locally, that is enormous progress, and I'm sure that we will have more progress, and it's good that everybody is discussing these issues and that people in the Church are also discussing them now.
Daniel Goldhagen, you always challenge us, and I guess being challenged is a good thing. Thank you for being with us tonight. Daniel Goldhagen is author of A Moral Reckoning, The Role of the Catholic Church in the Holocaust and Its Unfulfilled Duty of Repair. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums in a moment. Soldiers in the military's most deployed unit reflect on a possible war with Iraq. This is On Point. Over the past decade, the 10th Mountain Division from Fort Drum in northern New York has been the most deployed unit in the United States military. Members of Fort Drum's 10,000-member Light Infantry Division were the first sent to Afghanistan and would almost certainly be among the first to depart for Iraq. On Point contributor David Summerstein talked to Fort Drum soldiers and their spouses just off the base to hear what they're saying, what they're thinking about the looming war on Iraq. Here is some of what they had to say.
My name is PFC Broughton, 132 Infantry Division, Fort Drum, New York. Well, right now we're on status to leave. Something happens at any time, we're on 2-hour recall. So we just kind of take it one day at a time. Whatever happens, happens. We know what our job is, so we just kind of wait around. It's kind of nervous, not knowing what's going on over there and just waiting. Definitely stepped up the training, going to the field a lot more, going to a lot of different ranges. Definitely getting ready for whatever's going to happen in the new year. Washington kind of looks over the people that are actually here doing the fight, and they really don't care much for us. I mean, they kind of, I don't think it's our business to go with it, so I think we should just leave them alone until they do something wrong. But I always feel like we always have to be the band-aid for other countries, and innocent people have to die for that. No, I think we should probably finish up with Afghanistan first, because I think there's a lot more there that they're telling everybody and kind of taking too much on our plate at one time. I think that Bush is just kind of looking to get everybody at once, because we're already over there now, and America's backing them 100% on terrorism, so might as well go for it now.
My name is Private Jeremy Bartosik. It doesn't bother me too much. I mean, being away from family and friends is hard, but, you know, it's a job. So if they tell me to go somewhere, then I'll go. I guess my honest personal opinion is he needs to go. He's been a terrible leader ever since he's, you know, been president of his country, so... he's horrible to his people. He's horrible to other people. He's interacting with terrorists, which affects us, so he's got to go. But I'm willing to do it. That's why I joined the infantry.
My name's Elizabeth Perkins. My husband's name's Ryan Perkins. He's an E-4. Believe it when you get the orders. If you jumped every time the president said something, you'd be jumpy. I think he should go to the front line and see what's going on himself instead of just sending people. But I don't think he's thinking of people. I don't think he's thinking about the families of the soldiers that are actually going through it. The way I'm looking at it, I guess, is that they just got back from Afghanistan. A lot of the soldiers did, and a lot of them that just got back are now leaving again. And I just don't think that's right. You wait for it. I don't know. Don't really give it too much thought. You just kind of go with it. You don't want them to go, but, you know, push comes to shove.
The voices of soldiers and the spouse of a soldier stationed at Fort Drum, just outside Watertown, New York. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Amata, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Oliver Reed. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Cassettes and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our